Okay, so what I showed you last time was sort of, I hope what I showed you last time was the complete picture of why you do perturbation theory. That is, perturbation theory provides you a way to attack a very, very difficult problem and reduce a difficult problem to an infinite number of relatively easy problems. The downside of perturbation theory is that almost always a perturbation series is divergent. Or if it isn't divergent, it's usually very slowly convergent. And the question is, are you stuck? Once you derive a perturbation expansion, now that you've spent all that time, was your time worth it? And the answer is that when you learn summation theory, what you've really done is justified learning perturbation theory. Okay, so that is the bottom line here. what I also showed you was that summation theory is a technique that relies very heavily on the techniques and the methods of complex variables. And these techniques involve some unusual properties, like the Herglotz property of a function. And in any case, today I want to tell you, the principal thing I want to tell you about is complex variables. But it occurs to me that that it would be fun maybe to show you one of the properties of Herglotz functions that actually has some physical significance. Okay, so I defined for you what is meant by a Herglotz function, and I argued that if you're solving a Schrödinger equation like this, okay, if you're solving a Schrödinger equation like that, what I argued was that the function E of epsilon is Herglotz. And just to show you a slightly peculiar but interesting theorem, let me prove to you the following. If you have a function E of epsilon that is Herglotz, and you expand it into a perturbation series in powers of epsilon, the radius of convergence of that perturbation series cannot be infinite. Okay? It must be finite. It might be zero, but it cannot be infinite. Okay? Except in absolutely trivial cases. So the question is, so what I'm telling you is that square root singularities that correspond to level crossing have to occur in the epsilon plane. They cannot avoid making an appearance. They must occur. Okay. So in other words, what I'm going to prove to you is that if you have a function, say f of x, if f of x is Herglotz and entire, okay, so this is the key point. If you have a function f of x that is Herglotz and entire, what does entire mean? Just make sure. Analytic everywhere. No singularities in the complex plane. Okay, so if you have a function that is entire, what that means is that if you expand f of x in a Taylor series, that Taylor series converges everywhere. The radius of, so if you just have an entire function, the radius of convergence is infinity. Okay, and that would be lovely. If we did a perturbation expansion, it would be wonderful if the radius of convergence of the perturbation expansion was infinite. And I'm going to show you that can never happen. or it can only happen in utterly trivial cases. So here's the theorem. If this is an actual theorem, I almost never prove theorems, but I thought this was kind of cute. If f of x is both Herglotz and entire, then f of x is trivial, i.e., f of x has the form ax plus b. That's all. The only function that's both Herglotz and entire is a linear function. Okay? So how do you prove this? Let's suppose that we have a function that is entire. If we have a function that's entire, you can express this function as a Taylor series of this form. Okay? And that means that f of x is a sub n x to the n. This is your perturbation series. Okay? And what are we going to do? Since we know that f of x is Herglotz, it means that if I take the imaginary part of f of x, which is the imaginary part of this Taylor series, it has the same sign as the imaginary part of x. OK? Is that clear? So in other words, if I say let x equal r e to the I theta, then this is a sub n r to the n e to the I n theta. Okay? And the imaginary part of x would be r times sine of theta. Okay? Now, let's assume that this is a real perturbation series. That is, we are solving a real problem. Okay? So the energy is, we're calculating, say, the energy. The coefficients of the perturbation series must be real. Okay, is that clear? Maybe someone could close the door, because making coffee out there is kind of... Okay, so we're assuming that these coefficients are real. So when I take the imaginary part, what do I get? I get the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n, r to the n, times sine of n theta. And this guy has to have the same sign as r sine of theta. And this is very interesting. And the reason why I'm telling you this is that it occurred to me, I look back in my memory, and I remember saying something about Fourier series. And this is a Fourier series. OK, it's a Fourier sine series. And the question is, now what do we do? And we will do something really simple, really, really simple. Let me point out that sine of that n sine of theta plus or minus sine of, or let's call it m sine of theta plus or minus the sine of m theta has the same sign. Unfortunately, we have sine and sign. Sorry about that. Okay, so m sine of theta plus or minus sine of m theta has the same sign as sine of theta. In other words, adding or subtracting sine of m theta to m sine of theta cannot change the sign. Okay, that's just a simple inequality. Okay, that's just a geometrical inequality. Okay? So you can guess what I'm going to do. What I'm going to do is take this and multiply this Fourier series by it, and then I'm going to integrate from, say, 0 to pi. Okay? Now, on the right-hand side of my same sign as, as, it will be positive. Okay, because I'll have here sine squared, and when I integrate, I'll get some positive number. Okay, whereas on the left side, you know what's going to happen when I integrate. Sine of theta, when I integrate from 0 to pi, is going, all of those integrals are going to vanish except for the very first term here. And sine of m theta, all of those integrals are going to vanish except for the mth term. Okay, so therefore, on the left side, I'm going to only have two terms remaining. The term corresponding to n equals 1 is m times a1 times r. Okay, a1 times m times r to the power 1 and times some factor of pi over 2, which I don't care about. Okay? The second term will be plus or minus. And when I pick out the mth term, I will get a sub m r to the m, okay? Okay, is that clear? And this has to have the same sign, or we no longer have to say that. This has to be positive because the right-hand side is going to be positive, okay? So this is positive. Okay, this must be positive, but that's not possible, right? Because if I take r sufficiently large, this term will dominate over that term. Okay, is that clear? This term can always be made arbitrarily large in magnitude, and therefore the sign can clearly be made negative, which is a contradiction. Therefore, the only possible conclusion is that a sub m is equal to 0 for m greater than 1. And therefore, I conclude that the function must be linear. It's a trivial perturbation series. Okay? So if you do perturbation theory, and you go to second order in perturbation theory, and you find a non-zero coefficient to second order in perturbation theory, what do you conclude? Right away, the perturbation series must have a finite, non-infinite, but finite, radius of convergence. Okay? So once you know that a function is Herglotz, you know a tremendous amount about that function. It cannot be an entire function. Okay? There must be singularities in the complex plane. Okay. Any questions about that? I think that's a kind of a cool result. Okay.
How did you say that that quantity in the box has the same...
Because clearly, if m gets, you know, for large values of m, this m is getting very big. And just draw a picture. Okay, I'm not going to prove it to you. If you just draw a picture of sine of m theta and compare it with sine of theta multiplied by m, okay, this can never be as big as this. So whether you add it or subtract it cannot change the sine of theta, m sine theta. Okay? So in particular, we're interested in the region from 0 to pi, and this can never change the sine of that. Okay? In fact, we can even integrate from 0 to pi over 2. Make sure that that's true. Okay. Okay. So that's just entertainment. The more important thing is this. Suppose you're solving a problem like this. And suppose you don't know what a Feynman diagram is, and you want to calculate the energy perturbatively. Let me just summarize a cute, quick way to do the perturbation expansion. Okay? Now, I know that you've studied perturbation theory for the Schrodinger equation, but let me show you a slightly faster and more clever and efficient way of doing perturbation theory. Let's go after the ground state energy. Okay? So E, we will just calculate the ground state here. And the assumption is that that you can solve the unperturbed problem. That is, you can solve the problem minus 1 half d squared dx squared plus v of x times psi equals e0 times psi. Let's call that psi 0. OK? This is the assumption. You can solve the unperturbed problem, and you can find the ground state energy e0. And now what you would like to do is to solve the full problem, which is a very non-trivial, very difficult problem. And to solve it by perturbation theory, let's just, it's important that you see the structure of the answer. Okay? So, so we assume that E of epsilon is a series of the form n equals 0 to infinity, epsilon to the n, epsilon sub E sub n. Okay? That's the perturbation expansion of E. And we're also assuming that psi has a perturbation expansion, sum from n equals 0 to infinity, epsilon to the n, psi sub n of x. Okay? And now what I'm going to do is substitute this expansion and this expansion into here. And we've talked about that before, but now I actually want to do it and show you how it works. Okay? So we then, now you notice, by the way, I'm using equal signs here and here. And typically, this is going to be a divergent series. So I could put little quotation marks around those equal signs. These are formal Taylor series. And we know that almost always, we're going to end up with a divergent series here. Okay? However, it is still justified to compare powers of epsilon, even if the series is divergent, because asymptotic series also have unique coefficients in an asymptotic expansion. Okay? And now what I do is, so I substitute this in, and I look at the coefficient of epsilon to the power n. What is the coefficient? Well, in the first term, there are two derivatives, right? So therefore, I have minus 1 half psi n prime prime. Okay? Now I go to the second term, which contains v of x. So that gives me v of x times psi n. Okay? Then I go to this term here, but you notice there's an epsilon here. Okay? Therefore, can you please tell me what's the coefficient of the next term? What is the next term? Say it again? Okay. So times w, okay, so it's w times psi n minus 1, okay? And then on the right-hand side, this is a little more complicated because this is a sum. This, when we pick out the coefficient of epsilon to the n, we are multiplying this series times that series. So the coefficient of epsilon to the n contains that's a convolution, and it contains n plus 1 different terms. It is a sum, let's say, from j equals 0 to n of psi sub j e sub n minus j. OK? And what I'm going to do, by the way, I think a simple thing to do, is to write out, is to take off the first term and the, let me just do it here, to take off the first term and the last term in that sum. Okay? So instead of summing from j equals 0 to n, I'm going to sum from j equals 1 to n minus 1. And then I'm going to write down separately psi 0 e n plus psi n e 0. Okay? Now, this is a differential equation for psi n. Why is it that perturbation theory allows us to crack this problem? Why is it that perturbation theory reduces what is a very, very difficult problem to a sequence of very easy problems? Can you say why? Why is it? You are exactly right. That is exactly the point. Why is it that perturbation theory works? Because we're assuming that we're working iteratively. We're assuming that we know everything except for psi n. We know psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, and e0, e1, e2, e3, up to but not including en and psi n. We don't know that. So the equation for psi n contains, here's psi n over here, and here is a psi n over here. And it is the same differential equation, and here, okay, the differential equation for psi n is exactly the same as the differential equation for psi 0, except that it has this junk, these inhomogeneous terms. But the point is this. If you can solve a homogeneous equation, you can always solve the corresponding inhomogeneous linear differential equation, always. Okay? And there are two techniques. One of them is a fancy technique called, well, do you know what it's called, actually? Variation of parameters, okay? But there's a much simpler technique, which is called reduction of order, okay? So the point is, we are assuming that we can solve this problem here, okay? That's the fundamental assumption here. We know how to solve this problem, and we're looking for psi n. So what does reduction of order consist of doing? It's totally trivial. All we do is we say, let psi n be equal to psi 0, which is known, times some unknown function. Let's call it qn. Okay, that's the standard substitution that you make. That's all. That's all you have to do. And I'm going to substitute that into this equation. And let's see what happens. The first term, I have to take two derivatives of the product psi 0 times qn. So when I take two derivatives, I have minus 1 half psi 0 prime prime times qn, minus 1 half psi 0 qn prime prime, minus psi 0 prime qn prime. OK? Just two derivatives of the product. OK? And the rest is completely trivial. V of x times psi, that gives me V of x times psi 0 times qn. Then we have w times psi n minus 1. So it's w of x times psi 0 times qn minus 1. Okay. And then on the other side of the equation, we have a psi 0 times the sum from j equals 1 to n minus 1 times qj e sub n minus j. And then there's this piece, and there's nothing to do there, psi 0 times en. And then there's this piece, which is psi 0 times qn times e0. This looks very messy, but remember that we already know how to solve the zeroth order equation in perturbation theory. Okay. So that gives us an immediate simplification. Okay, this says two derivatives of psi 0, and then combine that with v times psi 0 is equal to e0 times psi 0. Okay? So here is the e0 times psi 0. Here is the v times psi 0. Okay? And here is the two derivatives times psi 0, except the three underlying terms are multiplied by qn. But it doesn't matter that they're multiplied by qn. These three terms can already be subtracted from the differential equation. So this is already equal to the right-hand side, and we can subtract it off. OK? And now we have a differential equation for qn prime prime. And the question is, what do we do with that differential equation? Can we solve that differential equation? We're using reduction of order. We should be able to solve this differential equation for qn. Can you tell me how you do it? It's a linear second-order differential equation what do we do?
Write down its characteristic equation, solve for, like ours.
What do you mean by characteristic? This is a linear ordinary differential equation.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Okay. So what do you mean by
the homogeneous equation?
Yeah. So maybe I'm not being clear enough. Let's polish this equation up a little bit. Okay? This is one of the inhomogeneous terms. Let me put it on the other side as minus W of X times psi 0 times qn minus 1. Okay? So it's on the other side of the equation. The crossed out terms are missing. We have canceled them. Okay? And finally, you notice there is a minus sign and a factor of 2, which are kind of irrelevant. But let's multiply the whole thing by minus 2 so that this becomes plus and plus 2. Okay, this is the unknown thing, qn. This is just some inhomogeneous junk, and all this is known. Say it again. What did you say? Ah, that's the word I was looking for, integrated factor. Now, have we made progress? Do you see that? Why is it that we've made progress? I mean, we started out trying to solve a second-order linear equation. We still have a second-order linear equation, right? Not right. This is a first-order linear equation. That's why we've made progress. That's how reduction of order works, because it is a first-order equation for q prime. Q does not appear, only q prime and q double prime. So it is a first-order differential equation, and such an equation is solved by an integrating factor. So now you know what I'm going to ask you. What's the integrating factor? Can anybody see the function that you have to multiply by to make this into a total derivative here? This is a 2 over here, not a z. Okay. Say it again? No, not e. No. Exactly. Exactly. It's psi 0 itself. OK, who said that? Yeah, you said it. Exactly. So the integrating factor is just psi 0. Let's see why. OK, so I take this equation, I multiply by psi 0. So psi 0 appears squared here, and there is an additional factor of psi 0 here. And you notice that all of these terms on the right-hand side are proportional. Everything here contains a psi 0. So if you allow me, I will factor out psi 0 squared from everything. Psi 0, psi 0. OK? OK. Now, why was this the integrating factor? Because if you just look at this, this is precisely d by dx of psi 0 squared times qn prime. This is a total derivative. So that was the integrating factor. It couldn't be more beautiful. Okay. So now what do we do? Well, since this is a total derivative, let's integrate it. And just for fun, let's integrate this from minus infinity to plus infinity. Now, we are assuming that psi 0 goes to 0 as x goes to plus or minus infinity. That's the boundary condition on the eigenfunction. So the left-hand side, we assume, is going to 0 because of that boundary condition. And therefore, the only thing that survives is the integral of the right-hand side. Okay? So the integral of the right-hand side must be 0. But if the integral of the right-hand side is 0, I can now solve for en. Okay? So if I simply integrate it, I have three terms. Let me put en on the other side of the equation, and I get en is equal to, in the denominator, is just the integral of psi naught squared. The integral of psi naught squared from minus infinity to infinity. And in the numerator, I have, since I put this on the other side, this minus sign becomes a plus sign, w of x times q sub n minus 1 times psi 0 squared. And this term is minus the integral from minus infinity to infinity, sum from 1 to n minus 1, qj times e sub n minus j. OK? Times psi 0 squared dx. OK? That's the formula for the nth correction to the energy. There it is. OK? Usually in perturbation theory, you're given a very, very complicated expression with all sorts of denominators. But in fact, this circumvents the whole thing. This is the next term in the energy. However, to get the next term in the energy, you notice that you need all the q's. How do you find all the q's? Well, we assume that we know all of the q's up to qn, but we've got to find the next q, right? So assuming I know all the q's up through qn minus 1 and all the e's up through en minus 1, I can calculate en. Now I go back to this equation, and instead of integrating it from 0 to infinity, let me integrate it from, say, or from minus infinity to infinity, let me integrate it from minus infinity up to, say, x. Okay? If I integrate this now from minus infinity up to x, the left-hand side gives me, I just take away that derivative sign, the left-hand side gives me this. And the right-hand side gives me the integral from minus infinity up to x. And now you see the rest of the calculation. I divide both sides by sine naught squared. And I integrate it again. OK? So I do another integral, say, from minus infinity up to x. That takes away that derivative sign. And now I know qn. That's it. OK? Or if you don't like minus infinity, I can integrate from 0 up to x. It's usually, in practice, more convenient to do that. So here's the final result. It's kind of messy, but then again, this is an extremely difficult problem. And the messiness is just secretarial work. Okay? There's no fundamental difficulty here. What you do is this. First, when you start off your perturbative calculation, you calculate E1. But before you can calculate E2, you need Q1. So you go from this equation to this equation, and you calculate Q1. Now that you know Q1, you go and calculate E2. And then you calculate Q2 and E3 and Q3, and you go back and forth. What is it that you're doing? You're finding the correction to the eigenvalue, and then you're finding the correction to the eigenfunction, and then you're finding the next correction to the eigenvalue and the next correction to the eigenfunction. This is very boring, but that's how it works. So why is it that we study Feynman diagrams? The reason we study Feynman diagrams, and this is an amazing fact, we don't have to go back and forth anymore. When we do Feynman diagrams, we can calculate the corrections to the energy without ever calculating the wave function. This is the reason why we can use Feynman diagrams, I mean, to our advantage. That's why Feynman diagrams are really clever. We can calculate the energy directly without ever calculating a perturbative correction to the eigenfunction. We go directly to the energy. OK, so now I'm going to give you a 5-minute classic comics explanation of what a Feynman diagram is. OK, and I suspect that you don't get this in most textbooks. OK, so maybe, let's see, I'll put it over here. So what is a Feynman diagram? So to reduce it down to its simplest terms, a Feynman diagram is nothing but a collection of dots, which we call vertices, and lines. OK? However, let me give you an explanation of what a vertex and what a line is. A vertex, in general, in complete generality, a vertex is a nice heavy dot okay, with some connections. And this is an N vertex, so I have N line, N connections here, N connection points here, or I don't know how you'd like to say that. There are N little pigtails that I can attach lines to. That's it. That's called an N vertex. We will call that an N vertex. Okay? The only other component, the only other part of a Feynman diagram is a line. Now, you may think, so now let me show you what a line is. To make a line, what you do is you put a dot down on a piece of paper, and you draw a bunch of lines coming out of it. Okay? That's what a line is in general. Now, most lines only have two ends to them. Okay? So a two line looks like this. There's some little dot in the middle, and it has two attachment things coming off, two pieces coming off. But a line doesn't have to have two ends. For example, it can have three ends. This is also a line with three ends. And I want you to notice that a line looks a lot like a vertex. And that's because Feynman diagrams have a fundamental duality in them. Vertices and lines have exactly the same topology. Okay? So a vertex is a dot with many attachment points. A line is also a dot with many attachment points, although usually in quantum field theory, a line has only two ends to it. But in general, it can have n ends. Okay, so how do you make a Feynman diagram? It's easy. You just assemble a bunch of vertices and a bunch of lines, and you connect the dots. What could be simpler? Okay, so for example, if I have a two line, which looks like this, and say a four vertex, which looks like this, okay, how do you make a Feynman diagram? You just use the line to connect up the dots. Okay? So, for example, if I want to use just one vertex, I do this. Here is my line, and here's my vertex. So there's a Feynman diagram. Okay? If I have a four line and a four vertex, how do I make a Feynman diagram? Well, the Feynman diagram, here's the vertex with four attachment points coming off. And here is a line with four pieces coming off. And I simply connect the line to the vertex. Okay? And that's the only Feynman diagram that I can make. Of course, you can make more Feynman diagrams if you allow the possibility of more vertices. By the way, a line also can have one end. It's possible to have a one line. So here's a one line. It looks like this. Okay? And if I wanted to connect it, say, to a three vertex, which would look like this, I can only draw one Feynman diagram, and it looks like this. Here's the vertex, and three lines coming out. Okay? This is a line with just one end. Okay? Is that clear? Now, you only need to know one thing, and that, which is a technical issue, which has to do with the notion of a symmetry number. Now, I know that you've discussed symmetry numbers. Are you good at it? For example, what is the symmetry number of that graph? Does anybody know? You're right. It's 1/8. That's right. 1/8. What's the symmetry number of this graph? That's actually hard. No. The question is, how do we turn this graph into itself without distorting the topology? So the answer is you can rotate this graph into four positions, okay? And you can also interchange, say, those two points. So you get 4 cents for rotating it and 2 cents for the interchange, which gives you 2 times 4, which is 8. And the symmetry number of this graph is 1/8. Okay? So, okay, that's all you need to know. And now I'm going to tell you one simple theorem, and that's all you need to know about Feynman diagrams. Yeah?
Picture with the, when you attached a one line to a three vertex.
Mm-hmm.
Are there 3 1 lines in that picture, or are there
one? There are 3 1 lines.
Okay. And in that figure.
So here's the little dot from which the line end emerges. Okay. So here's a one line. This thing here is a one line. This thing is a one line. This thing is a one line. That's a three vertex. Okay.
And similarly, in the figure 8 vertex, there is 1 4 vertex in that.
So here is a four vertex right there, and 2 lines having 2 ends each.
Right.
Okay. So now all I'm going to do now is tell you a theorem. I'm not going to prove the theorem, but it's a very simple theorem about combinatorics. And it contains absolutely everything you need to know about Feynman diagrams. And it's very simply this. Take the function e to the sum from 1 to infinity, a sub n, d by dx to the n over n factorial. Okay. So this is a differential operator, and it's in the exponent. Okay? And I'm going to let this differential operator operate on the sum from 1 to infinity of b sub n, x to the n, over n factorial. Okay? And after this differential operator operates on that exponential, I'm going to set x equal to 0. Okay? That's all. And the question is, what is that equal to? And the answer is, this is equal to 1. So how do you, by the way, just to make sure you understand what I'm saying, how do you, what do you mean by e to the d by dx? How do you interpret that? Yeah.
Right out of the Taylor series.
Precise. Okay? So you expand this into a Taylor series in powers of d by dx, and then you operate on this function, just taking the derivatives as indicated. And of course, there are an infinite number of terms here. It can be very, very complicated, but it doesn't matter. Okay? So we expand this out, we take derivatives, and when we're done taking derivatives, we set x equal to 0. Here's the statement of the theorem. This is equal to 1 plus the sum of all Feynman graphs multiplied by their symmetry numbers, multiplied by symmetry numbers, okay, where, and these graphs are built out of all possible ways that you can combine n lines with n vertices, or m vertices, okay? So using a sub n for every n vertex and b sub n for every n line. And that's it. That's the theorem. That's a combinatorics theorem, and you need to know nothing more than this fact about Feynman diagrams. Well, maybe one little thing beyond this. Okay, that's it. Okay, that's what a Feynman diagram is. So I haven't said anything about, you know, propagators or, you know, contractions, functional integrals. I haven't said anything about that. This is how you generate, in general, Feynman diagrams. Okay, that's where the Feynman diagrams come from. Okay, yeah.
What do you mean by using AN? Do you
okay,
mean that
so these are the so-called Feynman rules.
Okay,
now, when I said before that this theory has a duality, you notice I said using AN for every N vertex and BN for every N line. So I'm thinking of this here as all possible lines and this as all possible vertices. But you don't have to do that. It doesn't make any difference whether you switch, whether you interchange lines or vertices. So if you wish, if it's more convenient for you, if it helps you think about the problem better, you could just switch this to the word line and this to the word vertex, and you will get exactly the same answer. It doesn't make any difference. Okay? So that's a fundamental duality, and you can replace, in other words, x by d by dx. It doesn't make any difference. Okay? And that duality is actually related to the nature of a Fourier transform. Okay? So in a Fourier transform, you replace powers of x by derivatives and derivatives by power of x. Okay? So the question is, how do we use this fact? And let me show you let me give you an illustration of how you would use this fact. Before you ask, let me just illustrate, because this may answer your questions. So let's do a very simple problem. Let's consider the following integral. An integral from minus infinity to infinity, dx, okay? And I'm going to put in an exponential of, say, minus x squared over 2. People like to put in over 2. Say, minus epsilon x to the 4th. Just consider that integral. This integral converges. There's no problem with the existence of the integral. Okay? And if I wish, and actually, let me normalize this. So I'm going to normalize this, where this normalization is defined as the integral from minus infinity to infinity dx e to the minus x squared over 2. Okay, so it's just the integral of a Gaussian. Okay? Now, suppose you had this integral to evaluate. You look at it and you say, I can't evaluate that integral. That's too complicated for me. But I can surely study this integral. Let's call the integral I. Okay? I could surely evaluate this integral as a series in powers of epsilon. Right? So let me do that. So I can expand this term right here as a series in powers of epsilon and write that as 1 minus epsilon x to the 4th plus epsilon squared x to the 8th over 2 factorial and so on. Okay? And then I can integrate term by term. Okay? Now the first term, you can see what the first term is. The first term is precisely the normalization. Right? So the first term here is just 1. Is that clear? First term is just 1. The second term, how do we evaluate that? Well, there's a factor of epsilon. And to evaluate the integral of x to the 4th times e to the minus x squared over 2, I merely integrate by parts. I write x to the 4th as x times x cubed. I integrate the Gaussian. I differentiate x cubed. So I get a factor of 3. And then I do it again, so I get a factor of 1. So the answer is minus 3 epsilon. Okay? And to do this integral, I integrate by parts a bunch of times. You know, I write x to the 8th as x times x to the 7th. Integrate that, differentiate this. So I get 7 times 5 times 3 times 1. And 7 times 5 times 3 times 1 is 105. Okay? So it's plus 105 epsilon squared over 2 plus more terms. So I evaluated the integral. Now, what I want to show you is that I can get exactly this result by using Feynman diagrams. So how do we use Feynman diagrams? Well, it's unbelievably simple. all we do is we say, let me insert j times x into the integral. Now, you can't just put a j times x in the integral unless you evaluate this at j equals 0. Otherwise, you've changed the integral. Okay? But now you notice that there's a jx in the integral. So if I want, I can differentiate before I set j equal to 0. I could differentiate with respect to j. And that would give me a function of x. If I differentiate under the integral sign, it pulls down a factor of x. Is that clear? So what I could do is then rewrite this I of epsilon as 1 over n times e to the minus epsilon d by dj to the fourth power. Why? Because if I differentiate 4 times, I pull out 4 factors of x. If I differentiate four times in an exponent, I construct that function e to the minus epsilon x to the fourth. And you've seen this before, except as a functional integral. You've done exactly this before as a functional integral in other courses, right? So I can write this, and what I'm left with is the Gaussian integral dx e to the minus x squared over 2 plus jx. What am I going to do next? This is, oh yeah, this is evaluated at 0. Well, what am I going to do next? How do I evaluate that integral? Say it again. Well, not yet.
Complete the square.
Complete the square, OK. So what I'm going to do is subtract j squared over 2, right? But then I'll add back j squared over 2. OK, agreed? So the final result, so, and when I this is a constant, and I can pull it out of the integral. And this is just the Gaussian integral. And when I evaluate the Gaussian integral, it cancels this normalization. Agreed? So all that's left is e to the minus epsilon d by dj to the fourth power times e to the one half j squared. And this has to be evaluated at j equals 0. Okay. Now I look at this, and I say, ah, this is just an instance of this general combinatorial theorem. Okay. And what does it say? It says that if we want to think of this as a line, and we want to think of this as a vertex, okay. What kind of line do we have? Since there are two powers of j, we have a line with how many n's on it? 2. And that's the conventional case of a line. OK, so we have a 2 line. And what kind of vertex do we have? A 4 vertex. OK, that's clear. So now we need to know the Feynman rules. OK, and using this general statement, I can read off what the Feynman rules are. What are the Feynman rules? Well, for a four vertex, what do I write down? Say it again?
No. Vectorial epsilon.
Yes. So therefore, it's what?
Vectorial epsilon.
Four factorial. Okay. Notice that in the definition, there is included a factorial here. So if I divide by 4 factorial, I have to multiply by 4 factorial. So the number I put down at a vertex is minus 24 epsilon. That's the Feynman rule for a vertex. Is that clear? And what do I put down for a 2 line? Just 1. OK, that's very nice. So whenever I see a 2 line, I write the number 1. And here are the Feynman rules. Now let's start constructing the Feynman graphs. So we have a 4 vertex, and we have a line with 2 ends. And now we have to draw all possible Feynman diagrams. Okay, that's the rule. So let's draw all Feynman diagrams. that contain, that are of order epsilon to the first power. That is the same as saying all Feynman diagrams that have exactly one vertex. Okay? So here is the vertex, and it has four connections, and we're trying to draw all the Feynman diagrams that we can possibly draw built out of just one vertex, because that vertex is proportional to epsilon. What's the graph? What does it look like? Well, it's already on the board, as you say. And it looks like an infinity or a bow tie or whatever you like. So now let's evaluate this Feynman diagram. Okay. So first we need the symmetry number. Symmetry number. Then we need the vertex. And then we need the line. The Feynman rule for a line, for a vertex, and for a symmetry number. The symmetry number is, we said, 1/8. At the vertex, I put minus 24 times epsilon. And for the line, I write the number 1. I simply multiply these together, and I get minus 3 epsilon. Okay? And I look over here, and there's the minus 3 epsilon. Okay? There it is. Okay?
Where did the higher order terms come from?
These terms. Yeah, okay. So that's not the only Feynman diagram we can draw. There are an infinite number of Feynman diagrams. So this number, because it's proportional to epsilon squared, must be built out of Feynman diagrams containing two vertices. Okay? So let's draw all the Feynman diagrams that we can draw that contain two vertices. Okay, can you help me do that? Does anybody know how many graphs there are?
Connected or disconnected?
All graphs. We've never used the word connected, not yet. When I said to you there was one last little bit that you needed to know, I'll get to that in just a second. It's actually two tiny little bits that you need to know, but we'll get to that. But let's calculate all the Feynman diagrams with two vertices. How many are there?
Three.
Three of them. That's exactly right. There are three of them. Can you tell me what they are?
Two vertices.
Okay, so you have this one. Okay.
You have the one on the right of the board.
Okay. Then you have this one. Okay, and then?
Two
bow ties. Good. Okay. So this one and this one. So this is not a connected graph, but it's a graph. We have to include it. Okay? So now let's go through this calculation. We need to multiply. Yeah.
Sorry, how did you know how many lines to use?
How many lines? Well, remember, each vertex has this. This is a four vertex, so it has four attachment points. If we have two vertices, there are a total of 8 attachment points. But every line has two ends. Therefore, we know there must be four lines. OK? You can see it from here, okay? Because when I expand this out and expand this out, okay, into a Taylor series, and I operate, and then I set j equal to 0 at the end, I must take the same number of the derivatives. If I take too many derivatives, I get 0. If I take too few, it vanishes when I set j equal to 0. And so this is the only thing that's left. Okay, so the number of derivatives must match the number of powers. Okay, so let's evaluate the graphs. The key thing is the symmetry number. What's the symmetry number for this graph?
72 or something? 28?
36 or something? Oh my God, this sounds like a betting. A betting parlor. Symmetry number for this graph?
72 divided by 24 squared.
Okay. So the symmetry number for this graph. How many ways can you turn this graph into itself? Okay. No. Say it again. No. There's no three in that graph. There's no threefold symmetry in this graph at all. It's this graph. Okay. So what do I get? I get 2 cents for interchanging, for flipping that loop. I get 2 cents for flipping those two lines. I get 2 cents for flipping that loop. All those are independent symmetries of that graph. And finally, I get 2 cents for interchanging the two vertices. 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 is 116. Okay? What about this graph? What's the symmetry of that graph?
2 times 4 factorial?
Yes, that's right. These lines are all identical, so you get 24 cents for exchanging those lines, and you get 2 cents for interchanging the two vertices, so it's 1 over 48. Okay? And now, what about this? What's the symmetry of this graph?
1 over 16.
No. So far, I have not heard the right answer. Okay, the symmetry of this graph, we agreed, was 1/8. The symmetry of this graph is 1/8. Why is it 1/8? Because you get 2 cents for flipping that loop, 2 cents for flipping that loop, and 2 cents for interchanging the two loops.
128?
Right. How did you get that?
Because you can, each of those combinations goes with each of the other combinations, so it's 1/8 and 1/8, and then you can flip the two.
Exactly. There's one more symmetry, and that is you can interchange those two pieces, those two disconnected pieces of the graph. Okay? So the number here is 1 over 128. And now what do we have to get the final answer, what do we have to do? We have to add the graphs together multiplied by the Feynman rule for a line, which is trivial, just one, and the Feynman rule for the vertices, and we know what that is. It would be 24 epsilon squared, okay? Okay, that's it. And so let's add this together. There's a factor of epsilon squared that we can pull out from everything. And if, and let's see, I noticed that there is, there certainly is a 16, right, in the denominator here, here, and here. So to begin with, let me pull out a factor of 16. 4 from each of the 24s leaves 6 and 6, which is 36. Okay, so this is 36. And instead of 16s, I have 1 and 1/3 and 1/8. I guess that's what it is. Okay? And if I just combine this over a single denominator, the denominator contains a 24, right? So in the numerator, I would have 24 plus 8 plus 3, right? Which is 35 over 24 times 36 epsilon squared, 36 times epsilon squared. So therefore, it's 105 halves epsilon squared. That's the answer. Okay, and that is precisely this 105 over 2 epsilon squared. Okay, so that's how Feynman diagrams work. It's only that simple. Except there's two little things. Now you have a question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, a graph into itself.
You think of a graph, I mean, you've learned a little bit of group theory when you first did symmetry numbers. But what you learned is very formal. So what you are really doing is you are looking at a graph and looking at all the ways that you can turn the graph into itself by interchanging vertices or interchanging lines, okay, and leaving the graph invariant.
So
now, you must think of a graph as a bunch of dots in space connected by totally flexible wires. So what we're interested is in leaving the topology of the graph the same. Okay. So for example, let me see. I'll give you a hard example, or a harder example. If I gave you the graph, say, Okay, yeah, this would be a pretty good example here. Okay, now this is a graph consisting of four vertices. That's a graph consisting of four vertices. Okay, and each vertex is a three vertex. Okay, each vertex has three lines coming into it. Okay, and each of the lines in this graph are two lines, lines with two ends. What is the symmetry of that graph? Now, it's very hard to see what the symmetry of that graph is. It's really very, very hard. So what I do, the first thing I do, is I observe that this graph, it's in general, it's very hard to look at a graph and see the symmetry. So what I want you to do is, in your mind, don't think of this as as four points in a plane connected by wires across like this. Instead, think of it as a pyramid, a three-sided pyramid, okay, or a tetrahedron, in other words. Okay, now this tetrahedron, if you hold it up by a point here, it will always look the same. It doesn't matter which point you use to dangle this pyramid. Okay, so there are four possible points, so I can rotate it into four possible positions. Do you agree? Four possible positions. So now I will use that symmetry, and I will nail this into the blackboard. So I can no longer rotate this graph around in space and interchange vertices, because this graph, this vertex, has been nailed into the blackboard. But I have observed a symmetry of four. Okay? Now that this is nailed into the blackboard, are there any other symmetries? Yes. You can grab a hold of these three points that are dangling down, and you can rotate this pyramid into itself in three possible positions. Okay? Without changing this point. This is still nailed into the blackboard, but I can rotate that pyramid into three positions. So it's times three. Okay? But now that I've used that symmetry, I don't want to use it again, so I nail that into the blackboard. Is there any further symmetry? Yes. What's the symmetry? Yes. I can take these two points and interchange them. Of course, as I interchange the two points, imagine yourself as grabbing a hold of this wire connecting those two points and going like that. The question is, have you changed the graph? No. The graph goes into itself. Okay? So now I have observed that there's a symmetry of two. Okay, but now I have to nail this point into the blackboard because I never want to flip that again. And there's no further symmetry. That's it. Okay? Now, if I complicated this graph, and so the symmetry number is 124. Okay? If I made this graph more complicated by putting a loop on it like that, okay, now it's more complicated because I didn't have that fourfold symmetry to use at first. So what I would do would be, in my mind, I would think of it as a three-sided pyramid here with a loop on top. Okay? And that makes this vertex unique. Now, I get 2 cents here for flipping this vertex. Okay? I can interchange this vertex with itself. Okay? So I get 2 for that. But now the rest of the argument is exactly the same. So I can rotate these three vertices into three possible positions, and then I nail it down. And then I can flip these two, so I get a factor of 2 here and a factor of 3. 2 times 2 times 3, 4 times 3 is 12. So the symmetry factor of that graph, symmetry number of that graph, is a 12. Okay? That leaves the graph invariant.
Lines and vertices. Mm-hmm. That operation of flipping a line wouldn't be something because
that's a special case. That's a special case. And to understand that symmetry, you have to take this self loop and go like that.
So it seems like what you actually want is to break a Feynman graph made of lines and vertices into mm-hmm. something made out of new components. We can call them like big dots, little dots, and wires. And the symmetry will be something
that will leave it invariant.
Little dots to little dots, big dots to big dots, wires
right.
to wires.
That's right. And in fact, we can go a lot further, and I won't because we don't have time, but we can write a graph as a statement of how lines, how dots
yes.
are connected by lines, and that is a matrix. Okay? That connectivity is a matrix. It's a matrix that says position 1 is connected to position 4 three times. So I write 1, 2, 3, 4 for the vertex. 1, 2, 3, 4. Vertex number 1 is connected to vertex number 4 with three lines. And of course, vertex number 4 is connected to vertex number 1 three times, and so on. And I fill in this connectivity, and the symmetries of that matrix are the symmetries of the graph. The symmetries, but I won't go into that. Okay. So let's just leave it as an intuitive thing right now, because I just want to finish this by making two comments, two very short comments, and then point out something really interesting. Okay. So so the question is now, what if we were doing field theory? How do things change? And they only change in a trivial way. Because in field theory, you always begin with the structure of this form. But instead of it being an ordinary integral, it is a functional integral. That's all. So when you do what I did over here, instead of pulling out ordinary derivatives, there are functional derivatives. That's all. That's the only change. So this general theorem here remains invariant. But now, instead of writing d by dx to the n, you write functional derivative d by dj of x to the power n, okay, and you integrate with respect to x. That's a functional derivative. And instead of writing powers of x, you write j of x to the power n dx. That's all. That's the only change. Okay? Except that now we could make very interesting functions in here. Instead of having j of x to the power n, we might even have an integral dx dy, say, j squared, j of x times j of y, times maybe some function of x and y. There's much more general things that we can put in there. And this function of x and y, we call a propagator. And that goes into the Feynman rules. And you have to integrate over this function f of x and y. And that's a technical issue. And it means that it's complicated and difficult to evaluate Feynman graphs. OK, so that's the first point I wanted to make. The second point I wanted to make, a minor point, is that you often end up writing down Feynman graphs that have external legs. All the Feynman graphs that we've been writing down are Feynman graphs with no external legs. But you may see a Feynman graph, for example, that looks like this with two external legs coming off. In other words, I break this line over here and pull it out. And so I have an external leg here and an external leg here. How do you generate those Feynman graphs? It's easy. All you have to do is use exactly the same theorem. And if you want to have two external legs, all you have to do is take two derivatives with respect to x before you set x equal to 0. That's all. OK? And one last comment. Okay. One last comment. If we wanted to calculate an energy, and this is not something that I'm going to explain to you, because this is something I think you've had in other courses, this is called the partition function. And it is equal to the exponential of the energy. And in fact, this doesn't have the right dimensions, so it's times the volume of space. If you wanted to calculate the energy, then what would you have to do? You'd have to take the log of this to calculate the ground state energy. So one last fact. If you should take the log of this expression, does anybody know what that does? That's right. It doesn't change any of the Feynman rules. It doesn't change any of the counting of the graphs at all, except taking the logarithm is a filter. And all that it says is that you're to eliminate all graphs that are disconnected and only to include the graphs that are connected. That's what happens when you take a logarithm. That's the effect of a logarithm. A logarithm eliminates all but the connected graphs. So in this calculation here, for example, we would not include that graph. But we include the other graphs exactly as we did before. Okay. So let me conclude with just a one-minute remark. Why is it that perturbation theory is divergent? Why is it? Why have we been talking about that in this course? And the reason is, it's sort of obvious, there are a lot of graphs. And the question is, how many graphs? Okay. So we can make a very quick estimate, a quick and dirty estimate of how many graphs there are. If you were calculating, for example, in a phi to the 4 or an x to the 4 theory, if you were calculating in an x to the 4 theory where you have two lines and four vertices, okay, if you were calculating in such a theory, how many graphs are there? Can we make an estimate? It turns out it doesn't matter whether you add up the number of connected graphs or the number of disconnected graphs. It doesn't make the least bit of difference because the number of disconnected graphs is approximately equal to the number of connected graphs when you have graphs having many vertices. It doesn't make any difference. Okay? You might think it does, but it doesn't have any significant difference. Okay? So how many graphs are there? So let's count them up. It's a very simple counting problem. We will take n vertices, because we're interested in the coefficient of epsilon to the power n, just as we were calculating before. Okay? So I have n vertices like this. And we write them down here. Okay? And each vertex has four connection points like this. Now we have to connect them up to make a graph. So how do we make a graph? Well, we do it stepwise. I pick one of, I need to attach a line, right? So I take a two line and I attach it to this point. Okay, I start anywhere. And now, how many possible places are there for me to connect this line? Well, there are n graphs, and each graph has n attachment points. So altogether, and we've used one of the attachment points already, so there are altogether 4n minus 1 possible attachment points. Very simple, right? So suppose I attach it there. Now I pick another point, say this point. Okay? And I need to attach this to someplace. How many possible places can I attach it to? The answer is 4n minus 3 possible places. And I continue going, attaching lines as I go. Boom, 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 boom. How many possible ways were there for me to carry out this calculation? 4n minus 1 double factorial. It's just that simple. But I overcounted. Why? Because all of these vertices are identical. So the vertex that I count, you know, when I make a graph, this is vertex 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I could have counted those vertex 2, 1, 3, 4, 5. So I have to divide out by the number of possible arrangements of vertices. And furthermore, I ignored one other fact. When I attached this line to this vertex, had I attached it to this line, or that line, or that line, I would have arrived at exactly the same graph. So I have overcounted at each vertex by the order of the little pigtails coming out of each vertex, right? And there are four factorial arrangements of those little lines. So I have 24 to the power n. And that's the number of graphs. OK? Never mind their symmetry numbers, because that is a trivial effect. this is the estimate of the number of graphs we have. Okay? So n, 4n minus 1 factorial is roughly the same size as 2n factorial. And 2n factorial over n factorial is roughly n factorial. So altogether, this is n factorial times some constant to the power n. So how many graphs are there? There are altogether n factorial graphs times some constant to the n. I don't care really what this constant to the n is. This is the key thing. The number of graphs grows like n factorial. Okay? So each time you calculate a new order in perturbation theory, you have to do n times as much work as you have already done. So it gets hard fast. And why is it that perturbation theory diverges? Because the number of graphs diverges like n factorial. Okay? One last comment, but I won't talk about it in this course, but you might look into it if you're interested. You, if you're interested in statistical mechanics, you can study graphs having an infinite number of vertices. Okay? And you can think of these vertices as little particles, and you can study the statistical mechanics of graphs. So you put these vertices in a box, and they're connected up, and you can study groups and so on, and you can actually come up by doing a statistical analysis of graphs. Okay? So this is a statistical system. You can study a statistical analysis of graphs and actually come up with the precise divergence of perturbation theory. And perturbation theory diverges precisely, the nth term in perturbation theory diverges precisely like 3 to the n times n factorial. So this constant to the n, if you actually do the calculation right, keeping doing the statistical analysis very carefully, that's where the 3 to the n n factorial comes from. Very last comment, why is that important? The answer is because we have to know that when we sum the perturbation series, we have to know that we will get the unique answer to the problem. And this satisfies the Carloman condition, and that's why we need to know that. If we repeat this whole process for a phi to the sixth theory or an x to the sixth theory, then the number of graphs, it's not 4n minus 1 double factorial, it's 6n minus 1, and therefore we have a 2n factorial here, and we just barely satisfy the Carloman condition. Just barely. But if we had an x to the eighth theory, this would be instead of 6n minus 1 factorial, it would be 8n minus 1 factorial. And now when you take this ratio, the number of graphs would go like 3n factorial. We have violated the Carloman condition. And so when you use Pade theory to solve a phi to the eighth field theory, the Pades will converge because they're approximating a Stieltjes function, but they won't converge to a unique answer. The answer is lost. So expanding something in a Feynman series is actually throwing away some of the physical information that is unrecoverable, okay, using Pade theory. That doesn't mean it's unrecoverable, but using Pade theory, it cannot be recovered. So this is a very interesting question in information theory, and I invite you to look at it. It really is a beautiful and an interesting question. How do you use information theory to draw out all of the physical information contained in a perturbation series? Okay? And this is an open-ended research kind of topic. You could write 100 different PhD theses on this question. Very interesting. You could use, for example, maximum entropy, which is a technique for optimizing information, for extracting the optimal amount of information in an unbiased fashion. And if you do that, you can actually sum the series uniquely. But I won't go into that. Anyway, I hope you found this interesting. This I think, as much as we have time for. But I hope at least that I've given you an explanation of why we need to sum series. Okay? Good. Okay.
this series of stimulating lectures. I would like to award you this Perimeter Scholars T-shirt.
Terrific.
Thank you. Good help. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So I don't